For the week of March 27th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 317, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles at the Dolby Theater, I'm Michael Gills.
Wait, you're in Los Angeles and you didn't tell me?
Well, not really, but I'd like to be there for the American Idol finale. Sad as it is, I actually care again.
Wait a second. Isn't that why they said this was the final year? Because it's not only the finale of this season, it's the finale of the show.
Right, though already Simon Fuller, who's the producer of the show, the executive producer, says, oh, we'll be back in some form. It may be a year or two, and they'll revamp the show, but they will definitely bring back the franchise at some point. But this is a serious end. It's been 15 years. I was there at the season finale of season one when Kelly Clarkson won, and what a lucky show this is. They had Kelly Clarkson for season one, who's been a big star, made, you know, sold a lot of albums, legitimized the show. They've had other big winners like Carrie Underwood, and now they're ending with LaPortia. She's going to win it this week. I'm almost certain she will win it. She looks just like a lock. Like, not since Carrie Underwood have you felt, well, she's won it. You know, from day one, you're like, well, that's the winner. And so I think, you know, people don't sell albums anymore, but she will be a really good finale for the show, or legitimate talent that's going to sell albums to whatever degree that happens today. So lucky American Idol, 15 years. It's, and by some measure, the biggest hit in television history.
Wait, was it a bigger hit than MASH? I mean, MASH was a pretty big hit back in the day. And so was, of course, now, whenever you do this, I always get stumped.
Well, they're obviously huge moneymakers, the Law & Order franchise. It depends how you slice the numbers. But this show was number one more consecutive years in a row, changed than any other show in TV history, changed the rules, helped launch a lot of talent, made a lot of money. So, you know, by certain standard, who was number one more often, more times in a row? Idol is it.
Well, now, speaking of big smash hits, they may be smash hits, not necessarily critically, and I'm sure you know what we're talking about already. We were off last week, so we didn't get to talk about Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice and how it set records for apparently everything. It set every record.
Well, no, not, no, it did not.
But it beat Bolt in whatever category he's running in.
It did not set every record, and not even, you know, the all-time weekend record. So, no, it didn't. But the best headline was Batman v Superman v Bad. So that's what we'll talk about this week. But what else will we talk about on Showbiz Sandbox?
Well, before I tell you what we're going to talk about this week, I did want to put in up front, since I always forget to do it.
Again?
Again, I have to put something. You know why? Because next week is CinemaCon.
So what?
So I
miss another. Shouldn't you be reporting from CinemaCon? So last week we missed because you were in Mexico, and apparently there's no Wi-Fi in Mexico.
Well, not where I was.
Are you going to insult our Mexican viewers by telling them there's no good Wi-Fi? Maybe that wall is keeping the Wi-Fi signal from making it over to America.
My God. You know what? I'm going to tell Donald Trump on you.
Yeah. So that's why we missed last week.
That was my fault, and I apologize for that.
And then 2 weeks before that was Alaska. Which was also your fault. And now... and now you're going to miss next week.
Although, you know, maybe we could do a little brief show about what's going on at CinemaCon.
Absolutely. Well, you let us know by the end of the show whether you've decided that that can happen.
How am I going to know by the end of the show?
You'll think about it.
But certainly, if you stay tuned to our Twitter channel, that's not a channel so much as our Twitter account at Showbiz Sandbox, we tell you when we accidentally forget to tell you about.
How else can people reach us?
They can they can email us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. that's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. they can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Facebook, which is if you just search for Showbiz Sandbox on Facebook, we should pop up, and all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com.
And what will we talk about on this week's show?
Well, we're going to take a look at TV. And I don't mean we're just going to watch it. We're going to be talking about how NBC is proving that the difference between cable and network TV is disappearing, if not already long gone. And you know what? They're proving their former employee correct. You know who said that first?
No.
Conan O'Brien, when he went off to cable. Remember?
He said, I'm not sure he was first.
I know, but it makes much better, you know.
Okay, keep going.
Well, during Inside Baseball, we'll head over to the world of books, where best-selling author James Patterson continues his innovative ways. He was a leader in name-brand authors taking charge of their own media buys, and now he's pushing for the return of the dime store novel.
In other words, we were off for 2 weeks, and not much happened.
Pretty much, yes.
TV's sort of a lame grab bag, and the inside baseball interests me, but, you know, it's not a big week for news.
No, and maybe it's spring break. I don't know what happened. I mean, I didn't have...
Hollywood took the week off.
I guess so. I didn't have internet for 3 straight days. I came back to a million emails, none of them important. Anyway, of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
I have a guest in my house, and they're laughing because you just described me as entertainment journalist extraordinaire. Anyway, we're looking at the worldwide box office, not just North America. We have a link to RentTrack in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit and Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you name it. And the number one movie around the world, it's a flop, it's a hit, it's a flop, it's a hit. It's Batman versus Superman, Dawn of a Franchise. It grossed $137 million over the weekend. It's at just under $700 million worldwide, but it cost $250 million to make. That means by next week, it'll be profitable. And it looks like it's chugging on its way towards $800-900 million, something like that, unless it keeps falling hard. We'll have to see where it ends up.
And it bizarre. fell hard in North America.
Yeah, so what? 60, 70%. It made a lot of money. It's at $700 million already. Of course, it costs a lot. But, you know, they're like, they wrote stories. Do critics not matter anymore? Well, they never mattered. You know, and of course, we've seen people are still going, made a lot of money. It's just not going to have legs.
Well, and let me ask you something. And I was really disappointed that we didn't record last week because, you know what? This was a movie that when I heard Zack Snyder was making yet another Superman movie.
It's his second.
Yes. Okay.
Yet another?
Well, I mean, another, you know, big giant spectacle movie. I'm not a big fan of his work.
What are you, a critic?
No, I'm just saying I'm not a big fan of Zack Snyder's work. I like 300, but...
You like the homoeroticism of 300, yeah?
Okay, well, I liked it as a movie. I don't
tell
know
your,
about...
Tell your wife that.
I don't know about all that other stuff you just said, but, you know, I don't know, when I heard...
Well, he's not a good director. What are you... So what? Of course, we know he's not good. He made a bad movie. What's the shocker? Nothing.
What the shocker is that Warner Brothers and DC have said, you know what? Not a good director? And the movies that you're making with Superman and superheroes keep getting panned. You know what we should do? Put you in charge of the entire universe.
It's making money.
That's true. I guess at technically, that's all you really care about. But my question, and we talked about this in the past, does a movie like this that gets so universally panned, not only by critics, but even the people who are seeing it hate it, okay?
They didn't hate it. If they hated it, it wouldn't make $700 million worldwide.
Well, does this spoil the next film?
It makes it harder. It does. You have to, you know, but the one good thing is everybody loved Wonder Woman. She has practically a cameo in the movie, but they thought it was cool. I don't think he's directing that movie. That's the next one up. And if they can launch that successfully, they're going to be all right. You know, people can get excited again. But yeah, you keep making bad movies, it'll bite you in the butt, just like Divergent. On the other hand, when you make a good movie, even if it's not a franchise, it can make a lot of money. Look at Zootopia from Disney. Another $50 million over the weekend. That's at $780 million worldwide. It's practically doubling the gross of Kung Fu Panda 3. I never would have predicted that. It's doing terrifically good business all over the world. They'll probably make a sequel to that, won't they? We don't even know what the budget is, but it's certainly profitable.
You know, it's funny because I see kids under the age of like 10, 11 and under, okay, kind of doing lines from that movie the way some people do lines from The Godfather or Pulp Fiction or, you know, the way 20-year-olds
will. Well, they're doing it 20 years from now, it'll be like that. But it's a new movie, so they're quoting the movie they saw this week.
Yeah, just it's pretty.
That's cute.
Yeah, and they really do love it.
Well, there you go. And number three around the world is The Bodyguard. No, it's not the Whitney Houston film. It's a Hong Kong action movie directed and starring Sammo Hung. It's his first directorial effort in 20 years, and people showed up for it. $25 million on opening weekend. And number four is Kung Fu Panda 3, another $20 million. That's at $460 million worldwide, so that's a hit. It's not as big a hit, perhaps, as DreamWorks Animation would like, but it is there. And number five is Chongqing Hot Pot. Also opened up in the U.S. I love how all these Hong Kong and Asian movies and Bollywood movies, more and more, you're seeing them opening day and date in North America. This one is a Chinese action comedy. It made $20 million worldwide on opening weekend. And number six is the movie my mom saw, My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2. They liked it. $16 million over the weekend. $54 million worldwide, and it only costs $18 million to make. So they waited a long time. Again, just like Batman v Superman, did not get good reviews, but audiences didn't care. And number seven is a movie you might have been thinking of when you talked about the bad reviews and how that can hurt a franchise. It's Allegiant, the latest in the Divergent series. There's one more to go, unfortunately for them. $10 million over the weekend. This is a franchise that's falling hard. Batman v Superman's about to make $700 million and people are acting like it's a leper. This franchise, it only costs $110 million to make. Can I say that? Only $110 million to make? It's grossing $136 million worldwide. It's barely made its budget so far, and it's fallen off a cliff in every territory.
I've heard that they're cutting back the budget for the fourth film.
You haven't heard that. It was reported. It was in the trades.
Oh, okay. I didn't know it was in the trades. I didn't read it. Okay. So not only have I heard it, apparently, so have the trades.
It's true. And number eight is, Who Sleeps, My Bro? I don't know. It's the translation. It's a Chinese coming of age comedy. Looks like some dudes in high school getting in a feud with some other dudes, and they also want to have sex with girls. So apparently, growing up in China is just like growing up in Porky's era America. It grossed $10 million on opening weekend and looks dumb.
Well, what about Revenge of the Nerds era America?
Sure. And number nine is Miracles from Heaven, which obviously was timed to Easter weekend. It's a second weekend, I think. It grossed $10 million over the weekend. It's at $50 million and counting. And number 10, one of the best reviewed movies of the year so far, is 10 Cloverfield Lane. Another $10 million, $80 million worldwide.
But and here's the thing, $80 million worldwide, when you hear something from Batman v Superman and it's like making $10 trillion and you think, well, only $80 million, that's nothing. It only cost $15 million to make the movie.
That's right, and it was practically a in one room set. I'm surprised it cost 15. John Goodman must have got a lot of money for that one. And number 11 is God's Not Dead 2, another face-based? It's a face-based film. It's a faith-based film. $8 million on opening weekend. And number 12 is Deadpool, still chugging along, $755 million worldwide. Did you catch that? $755 million worldwide. Zootopia has made more money than Deadpool.
At the end of the day, I'm going to take everything I just said back. I was going to point out how Deadpool and Zootopia belong to the same studio, but not true. Deadpool actually belongs to Fox. So even though that's it's a right. Marvel property, it belongs to Fox.
And so that's about it for movies around the world. But of course, we're looking at Chinese box office as always. On opening weekend, you know I love to talk about 3D. Batman versus Superman, about 40% of its gross came from 3D. So that's a good showing. That means, however, that less than 40% of ticket sales came from 3D on opening weekend.
In North America, because 59% worldwide.
Yeah. And so it's even less in North America. You're right. You're right. No, those figures were for North America. I'm sure it was higher worldwide.
Yes, it was. It was 59%, 81% in places like Brazil. And I can tell you that in North America, the showtimes were roughly 42.7% 3D versus
I was at Union Square, which is basically the campus theater for NYU down here in New York City. And the 2D screenings were almost all sold out by noon, and none of the 3D screenings were sold out yet. So that, you know, vague, lame, what I saw was, you know, that's what I saw trending downtown in New York City. So where it ends up at second weekend, third weekend, I'm sure that the 3D numbers fell because I didn't hear anyone talking about it and saying, oh, you got to see it in 3D.
Yeah, no, I didn't hear any, even the critics didn't mention 3D as such.
But what I did hear a lot about was the worldwide grosses for Batman versus Superman. And this is a trend that we're seeing more and more, I think, not just, of course, in the trades, which even they were not doing it before a lot. They do it all the time now. Every week they have regular reports. And now we're seeing it even in the regular papers. And on TV, they're talking about, you know, New York One mentioned the worldwide gross of Batman versus Superman on opening weekend. You know, we were unusual. We were out there first.
And by we, you mean Showbiz Sandbox.
Yeah, who else?
Okay, and well, I didn't know.
I think in a year or two, this is going to be standard. You know why? Bigger numbers. It's more fun to say 300 million than 100 million, isn't it?
Well, there's a couple of legitimate reasons for that. The answer to your question is yes, it is more fun. But the practical reasons, if you will, are that, one, movies are opening day and date more and more around the world.
So they can do it.
Whereas before it would be like, well, it made, you know,
6 months later. Yeah.
Yeah, 6 months later. Oh, look, it opened big in Japan. You know, now, yes, you get that for China. You get, oh, it, you know, Jurassic World opened this week in China, even though it's 5 weeks after the rest of the
world. It's
still
a big number, so they're happy to say it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But when it's, you know, oh, just South Korea or just Singapore or just Indonesia and it's $10 million, you know, who wants to talk about that?
Well, that's a great point. It's day and date so that they can do it, which they couldn't do before. And of course, it's a bigger number.
Well, and the other reason is, of course, that you have companies such as RentTrack out there actually proffering these numbers. They're promoting them and letting the media know, hey, you can mention this on air or in your publications. Whereas before, you didn't really get
it. It was a secret.
It was a secret. You got it from North America. You didn't get it for the world necessarily. Or if it did, it was, as we just mentioned, it came weeks later, so it didn't matter.
Final reason, China. China's big news. Yes. No matter what, China is affecting our economy. China's affecting our politics. Everybody's talking about China, and their box office is on fire. It's as big. It's about to be bigger than North America. Their box office grew 50% in the first quarter of 2016. That's the same pace as the first quarter of 2015. So it's not letting up. And if that continues, they're going to pass $10 billion for this year.
Which means they will surpass 1 year early the U.
Necessarily surpass. So we'll see where we end up. Yeah. But they're going to be right neck and neck, breathing down our whatevers. Do you call a box office neck? I don't know. But I did not see a couple small movies. I want to see the Richard Linklater film. I must have clicked on something online because every time I go online, I see a trailer for that movie. Everybody wants some. The spiritual sequel to Dazed and Confused. I love that movie, and I want to see this one. And sneaking into the top 10 was Sally Field. And hello, my name is Doris, where she plays an elderly woman. Elderly, I mean, she's a mature woman who starts hitting on her younger male coworker, Max Greenfield. So who can blame her?
Well, and she doesn't look 70. I mean, does she look 70
to
you?
Is she 70?
Yes.
Bless her heart.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Gidget grows up.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, Batman versus Superman, it did not set it set an opening weekend record for March or whatever. Great. That's good.
I thought it was pre-summer.
Yeah, it made a lot of money, but it did not set an all-time record. And Batman has a long history of doing that. There have been 7 Batman movies in the most recent, iteration, starting with Michael Keaton, and 4 of them set an all-time opening weekend record. I mean, Batman is money in the bank. One of them that didn't was, of course, The Dark Knight Rises, which had a tragic shooting at the midnight screening, so that sort of messed up the opening weekend, which was still a monster, and that might have set an all-time record except for that terrible tragedy. So this is a franchise that makes a lot of money, so not setting an all-time record to me when you combine Batman and Superman,
and then you open it in March as opposed to the summer.
Well, that makes it harder to set an all-time record to a degree. However, it also means no competition.
Correct. Now, you said that these Batman movies have been setting opening weekend records all the way back to 1989 for the Michael Keaton Batman. You know, Tim Burton takes umbrage to that or offense to that. He likes to call it the Tim Burton version of Batman.
Well, I was just trying to remind people of who was in that first one, beyond the TV series spinoff. But, maybe you can bring it up with him at CinemaCon, assuming he's there. He probably has a movie coming out soon. I know Screening Room will be there, won't they?
Oh, I'm sure they will, but I don't know.
I don't know about sure, but it was big news that they were attending.
Yeah.
This what's Screening Room again?
Screening Room is where you go to see movies. No, okay. Screening Room is this Sean Parker project, this company that will bring movies to your home for $50. You have to buy a $150 set-top box, to keep the piracy down. That's the claim.
Down-ish.
Yeah, down-ish. And then you will be able to watch movies that open in movie theaters day and date. You'll be able to watch them in your home for $50, to which everybody says no.
Almost everybody.
Yeah, almost everybody. Anybody
the
that's
people
getting...
who have a piece of the company say, I don't know, it seems like a good idea.
Yeah, Brett Ratner, I see here, is softening his position.
He didn't really, though. That was a misleading headline. He did not. He just said, well, the technology looks good, but he still has all his issues with it. So that was a misleading story.
Ah, okay. That was a Variety story, I see.
And basically, the pitch from the Screen Room is, hey, I'm the guy who screwed up the music industry. Let me work on movies.
Yeah.
Kind of a hard sell for the guy from Napster.
Exactly. I haven't messed your industry up yet.
You're up next.
Exactly.
And of course, there's always TV. Will you be at the TV upfronts? Or that's in New York, so you won't be, will you?
I won't. And they're, unless you're an advertising executive, it's kind of a, kind of boring, frankly. You get to see a whole bunch
of... You think CinemaCon's exciting if you're not into distribution and exhibiting?
Oh, heck no. No, I mean, there's like 1 or 2 days.
Look at our new Klieg lights.
Well, I will say...
8.2 sound system.
The studio presentations are always interesting, if not fun, okay? Because they're showing you trailers from throughout the year, and usually, you know, they'll show stuff first there at CinemaCon. But, and sometimes, not always to their benefit. If you recall, a couple years back, they showed the high frame rate version of The Hobbit, or at least, you know, 20 minutes. And it did not look good. And people left going, oh, my God, what did he do?
What hath God wrought?
Yes. And that did not go very well. And then there are times where they show films like The Life of Pi, and people rush out of the theater. And they don't show the whole film. They'll show like, you know, 15 minutes. Yeah. And people thought, oh, my God, that looked amazing. And that's where the buzz around Life of Pi started.
Couldn't they recast it with white people? We could make even more money.
Exactly. And why do they have to have subtitles?
Well, gee, maybe you'll report to us from CinemaCon next week if you decide to get off your bum and do a show from there.
That's true. Although, again, I will be in a hotel where Wi-Fi is always iffy.
You're in a hotel in Mexico for CinemaCon?
No. I get it. Because, yeah.
That was your excuse last time.
You mean last week? Not last CinemaCon. Yes. Okay.
Oh, no, yeah. All right, so we're moving on to television, where they're having the upfronts. What are the upfronts, anyway?
That is when you're not in the back, actually.
Uh-huh. Keep going.
Okay, the upfronts are where television networks and cable networks, and in the case of NBC, television and cable networks combine to sell all of the series that they will be proffering, they will be airing in the fall.
You and proffering. Stop saying proffering.
I know. I don't know what it is with that word this week. But they have a whole bunch of shows that they would like to sell advertising against. And so
returning hits and new shows and all that.
And so they say, hey, look, advertisers, come one, come all. Don't you want to get a little piece of that Big Bang Theory? You know, you can reserve now, and that way you won't be shut out when, you know, the fall comes around and you want to advertise on a big hit television show. Look, you already own it. You already own, you know, 12 episodes worth of advertising. Don't worry. And they sell roughly between $9 and $19 billion. And I know that's a big wide range, but
that's a really big wide range.
But it depends on which, you know, if you're looking at just
what metric.
Yes, exactly. But you know,
they sell a lot of advertising.
And to give you some perspective there, $19 billion worth of advertising in some years, okay?
And that's like double what the box office is.
Exactly. That's where I was headed with that, is that it's a lot of advertising. It's a lot of, I think, like,
it's also a lot of expenses.
Yes, and a lot of the advertising is gone by the time the fall rolls around.
NBC made a lot of news. What did they do?
They took their broadcast network, which you can get, stick an antenna in the air, and you can get to all of your NBC shows. So Friends, Seinfeld.
Those aren't on NBC anymore.
Well, I know, but I'm stuck in the 90s. So in any case, whatever's on NBC now.
Chicago Fire, Chicago Hospital, Chicago Cops, Chicago whatever.
Blacklist.
Blacklist, the number one drama on NBC. Well, not anymore because of The Voice. Now it's Blind Spot is their number one drama, but The Blacklist is a huge hit, and they're having a spinoff. That's coming up in a couple weeks. They're going to do a spinoff of The Blacklist because that has been their number one drama for several years now, and they went face-to-face with Scandal, and they beat the heck out of it, and now that is the number one drama at 9 p.m. on Thursday. So that put NBC on the map on Thursday, so of course they're going to do a spinoff.
Of course, and that's NBC, that again, over the air. It's a broadcast channel.
But they also own a bunch of cable channels: Telemundo, Sci-Fi, or Sci-Fi, Bravo, USA, E, the Golf Channel, Oxygen, the Weather Channel, CNBC, MSNBC, on and on and on. NBC's cable conglomerate, all of their channels together, including network, they did nearly $6 billion in revenue last year in ad revenue. That's just from ad revenue. It doesn't count money they make in other ways. But they also reach 93% of U.S. viewers each month. Every month, almost everyone in America who watches TV watches an NBC channel at least once.
Well, now, and I wonder how they're qualifying that 93%, because
it says U.S. viewers.
Right. So,
you know, little babies and people who are, well, you know, whatever, people who don't watch TV at all. If you're a viewer, chances are you watch an NBC channel. It's not easy to believe, isn't it?
Well, again, it's the way something is said. So when they say they reach 93% of U.S. viewers, the question is, does that mean you're in their homes, or does that mean they're actually watching an NBC or
No. It means they did the viewer watches something from them, meaning you could be a college student watching a show on demand online. So it doesn't mean you sat down to watch it live. But no, I don't believe it means that you had the possibility of watching it. They're saying you saw some NBC content on these channels. Because otherwise that would be meaning that they reach 100% of viewers, of course.
No, not necessarily. And very
well of viewers, because viewers means you have access to TV. So it would have to be by definition 100%.
Not exactly. We'll get to that in a moment. In fact, we're going to be talking about that when we talk about the Dodgers, okay? Because really what they're talking about when they say that is they are in 90. Now, I don't know about this particular statistic, but very often you'll hear something said along the lines of they're in 77% or 85% of U.S. homes with televisions. Or, you know, basically they're saying that
it's there.
Doesn't mean they watched it. It's right. In other words, they're on those cable, you know, those little monopolies. That
that's not what they're talking about here.
And that's what,
because they're talking
is.
To advertisers about eyeballs, and they're saying that, you know, 93% of TVers watch something on an NBC channel each month. That's all. It's a pretty low bar, and I bet they reach it.
Yeah. And now whether they are in, you know, 100%,
but surely the stat would be like 99%. What eyeballs are there who watch TV that don't have access to an NBC channel?
Well, again, because you got, let's just look at it. MSNBC, CNBC, Weather Channel.
And NBC. Yeah, I mean, every channel is available online, so no matter what.
Well, I'm just going down the cable networks, just those cable networks that I just mentioned. They're all on basic. Golf Channel, I can't speak for.
It doesn't matter. Well, it just means one of them. What? How can you be a TV viewer and not have access to an NBC channel, even if you don't watch it? If you just watch online, you still have access to an NBC show. So there's no person who is a TV viewer that doesn't have access. They have 100% reach in people who actually could watch television.
That 100%. Is true. That is
right.
True.
So,
but isn't that true?
That's why the stats not refer to their reach. It refers to who watches the actual NBC content.
But it says reaches right there. Reaches.
I know, but okay, they're not using that the way you mean it. It's they're talking to advertisers, for God's sakes. There's nobody who doesn't have access to NBC.
Well, then that's good
for
NBC.
If you just have rabbit ears, you have NBC. If you're watching only online, you have access to an NBC television, one form or another. If you have cable, satellite, whatever, telephony, it doesn't matter. You have access to it. Doesn't mean you watch it, but they reach everybody. They have reached 100% of people who want to watch TV if they choose to.
They're certainly reaching more people in the morning.
Oh, my God. Okay, you're segueing. Thank you, Jesus. All right, yes. Bizarrely, the Today Show is beating up on Good Morning America. They've won a week. They're starting to win again. This is, things like this do not go back and forth like this, but the morning TV wars are heating up, and Today's Show beat Good Morning America, a legitimate beat. It was not like some caveat or some asterisk about hosts were out or, you know, anything like that. So that is a tight race, and Today is back on top of Good Morning America.
And remember, they were like on top. Today was on top of the morning race there for like 17 years, right? Something.
And now GMA has been on top for 4 years, 3 years plus, and now it's not swung all the way back yet. But NBC has clawed its way back to be within fighting distance and beating them sometimes. So that's really big news.
Well, and let me ask you. Okay, so I know I segued. That's big news. Do you think this whole, you know, combining of the broadcasts and the cable networks is...
I'm surprised they didn't do it before.
Same here. I mean, I completely agree. I mean, maybe they didn't do it before because they were trying to get around some FCC regulations, or they didn't want to be construed as certain things. But the reality is this. Comcast, which owns these cable networks, now owns NBC, okay? So it's the cable networks that now own the broadcast network. And NBC and CBS and all of these broadcast networks have been asking for retransmission fees for ages. So they're all pretty much the same thing anyway. Although, again, as you
say, I think
it's
also more just more and more money is going to cable. It's more of an equal player. So it's not such a, you know, it used to be the tiny amount you'd get for Bravo couldn't compare with the big amount you get for NBC. And now when you have a bunch of these channels, it all adds up to being kind of equal weight. So why split them apart? Why have two separate presentations? It just seems more efficient. But frankly, when I saw the story, I thought they were doing something like, hey, pay us money for an eyeball and we'll get it to you. Do you care whether it's on NBC or Bravo or CNBC or Sci-Fi? If we give you the demo you want, here's the easier way to buy ads.
You just qualified it right there. If we give you the demo you want. So in other words, if I get the 50-year-old...
businessman making six figures.
Yeah, on Blindspot or Blacklist, okay,
or CNBC.
Or CNBC. It doesn't really matter to me as long as I get that particular demographic. If if I only want young kids between the ages of 16 and 22,
it can be sci-fi, it can be NBC, I don't care.
Don't give me CNBC because I'm not going to get them.
Well, no. But I thought they were just going to be buying blind. I thought they were selling advertising in a new way and saying, we'll give you the eyeball. Don't you worry about where it lands.
Yeah, I don't think that's what
they're
doing.
We're going to get you that kid. It'll be a Saturday morning. It'll be prime time, whatever. Don't worry about it. You don't care anymore. All you want is the eyeball. And you don't care whether it's online or whether it's on TV. You know, I thought it was more some new innovative way of selling eyeballs, but it's not. It was just a way of presenting the information.
Yeah, it's basically a way of saying we're going to hold one event, not two.
Yes, exactly. And of course, cable news is hitting record ratings, literally record ratings. CNN's been doing really well, so that's great news for them because they should do well when there's a big breaking news event. But in the last few years, Fox has been beating them even in those circumstances. But it's an election year. Fox is doing great. CNN is doing great. They're tearing it up. You would expect them to make a lot of money and be very profitable, and they are, and the ratings are up. But CNN, just like Today's Show with GMA, is giving Fox News a run for its money for a change.
Do you think a part of that has to do with the candidate? Now, of course, news is supposed to be unbiased. It's supposed to be objective. But I think everyone, especially the former host of The Daily Show.
Historically, media has had, you know, open partisanship. You've had newspapers and magazines, you know, historically that were for the Whigs or were for the whomever. So, yes, we know that MSNBC is liberal and Fox News is conservative and CNN tries to play the middle.
Correct. And on the conservative agenda this year, or the conservative ticket, there seems to be some kind of fracas going on with Donald Trump and everything.
Some kind of fracas, is that what you call it?
Well, you know, I'm trying to just kind of skirt by the politics of it all.
But Fox hates Donald Trump and they're happy about it. They don't care who wins the election. They like to be in the opposition. That's when their ratings do better. They do better in the opposition, yelling and screaming about who's ever in power. So they were thrilled that Obama won. They were thrilled that Obama won re-election. It's harder for them when W was in office because they don't want to pick on him as much. So they love the idea of Donald. They can't lose this election year. Whether it's Donald Trump or Clinton or Bernie, they don't care. They're going to have a field day and their ratings will be higher.
Well, I guess my question is, given that people are shying away from Donald Trump, or I don't want to say...
Who's shying away? He's winning primaries.
Okay. There is a faction of the conservative movement that's shying away. Do you think
Thank you for the headline. Yes.
Yes. My question is, do you think that is playing into Fox?
They're not following the lead of the Republican leadership. The Republican leadership is following the lead of Fox News, more likely.
No.
There's not much difference between them.
No, but the fact that CNN is now able to catch up to them, do you think that has something to do with it? That's where I'm trying to go with that question.
Do you think CNN is doing better against Fox because Donald Trump is winning the Republican primary? No.
Okay. Well, it was a question, right?
It was. I didn't quite follow it, but I would have to say no because it doesn't make any sense to me.
Okay, fine. Well, sorry. Before we get off of cable for just a second, I know we have two other stories before we move on to the BAFTA nominations. Okay. One is about It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, okay, which is on a cable network. And I'm trying to remember which one. Is it on FX or, you know,
that's the thing these days. One just doesn't care.
You don't
remember anymore because you set a show to record and you don't even know when a new season starts, but suddenly it pops up on your DVR and you say, oh, there's new episodes of It's Always Sunny. Archer? I cannot remember. Is it on FX? Is it on FX?
Comedy Central?
Is it on Comedy Central?
Wait.
I don't remember, but I don't care.
Archer. Actually, now I'm concerned that it might be on the Cartoon
Archer
Network.
Is on FX, I believe.
Archer TV series. FX, you're right.
And It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is on
Comedy Central.
I thought you were looking it up. I don't know.
FX and FXX, whatever FXX is.
Well, FXX is reruns mostly. No, that's their show. That's where it airs new episodes. It helped launch the FXX brand, I believe.
Okay, so it's on FX.
FXX.
Look, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is on FX.
No, but the new episodes now air originally on FXX, I believe. I believe that's its home.
Okay.
Syndicated reruns can air anywhere and anytime, but I believe that's one of the key things about it, that they've done really well on FXX, the new channel that FX launched. Dear God, you're giving me a headache.
You know what? I think that they are confusing the situation by naming their two darn networks the same exact thing, except for one letter.
Right. So they've been renewed for two more seasons, just like they were last time. It's now going to tie The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet for the longest running live action sitcom in television history, broadcast or cable. All power to Ozzie and Harriet. I never saw an episode of that, though I have seen clips of Ricky Nelson singing his songs. And It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. I did watch a few episodes early on. I haven't kept up with it. But, you know, it's a classic cult show that's got an audience and can be profitable, even though it's never probably scored more than 3 million viewers in a week.
Well, now, okay, that's what's going on FX or FXX, okay? But back to NBC for a second, because they are trying to find out whether the American public can handle the truth, because Craig Zaden and Neil Marin, who produced the Oscars for a couple years, you remember them?
Yeah, and live musical events.
And live musical events. They're going to do a live production of A Few Good Men, the Aaron Sorkin play.
That's right. After the success of The Sound of Music, the very first one that has spawned now multiple ones from NBC and other networks, including Grease and the Passion event that happened on Fox, NBC immediately started talking about A Few Good Men. And it was a logical one to do. You're going to have a big star in the Jack Nicholson role. It's a big, meaty drama. And so, you know what? It'll work. Everything old is new again. TV used to live off of live plays. You know, they would put on a new play or a classic play and have big stars in it, and that was what television was. And they're coming back to it again, and it's going to work.
And I saw A Few Good Men on Broadway with Tom Hulce.
Oh, way back. In the Tom Cruise role.
I believe so. It was in the early 1990s.
So when they cast the movie, they said, we're going in a new direction.
Correct. We're going to go with a Tom. So Mr. Hulce, if that's, you know, any...
any comfort.
Yes, it's just not Tom Hulce. It's not you. It's Tom Cruise. In any case, okay, so that's NBC. Before we get on to the BAFTAs, one final little note here. Okay, now this is where I was headed earlier with the whole thing about being in a home, being in a television home. We've talked about this before. The Los Angeles Dodgers, big baseball team here in Southern California. Couple years
they
ago,
they tried to launch their own cable channel. Yes. They said, screw you, we want our own channel. Just like the Yankees had Yes Network. They wanted to make more money by saying, you got to get Sportsnet LA if you want to watch the Dodgers. Unfortunately, nobody wanted to carry it.
Well, yes, timing is everything. Okay. Now, to put this in perspective, the Dodgers were owned for umpteen, you know, a couple, like 40, 50 years. They sold for, you know, $300 million, $200 million to Rupert Murdoch. Murdoch then turned around and sold them to Frank McCourt in 2004, 2003, 2004, somewhere in there, for $450 million. And these are round figures, okay? So don't go emailing us with, I realize they're not exact figures. Then, 2 years ago, they were sold to a private equity firm for $2.7 billion. So it took about 70 years for them to get to $450 million, but it took 10 years for them to literally quadruple the value.
It's worth whatever you can sell it for. They sold it for a lot of money. They sold it at the peak market value. And now the new owners have it, and they're trying to monetize it more, and they're finding out they're in trouble.
Right. Well, the new owners bought it at that price because they said, we can turn around and cut a deal with Time Warner. Time Warner will pay us $8 billion. And Time Warner did pay them $8 billion, okay, or is over time. The problem is Time Warner can't then turn around and this network they created around the Dodgers, they were hoping that they would force that on every single subscriber to a pay television.
Part of the basic cable package.
Right. And guess what? Dish, DirecTV, the satellite providers are saying, yeah, no, we're not going to. Well, we don't want it at that price. We don't want it at 30% off. We don't want it on our basic cable at $3.80 per subscriber per month, because there are people out there that are A, sick of their bills going up, their cable bills going up, and B, they're not Dodger fans. They don't want it. Put it on a premium channel.
Most episodes, you'd have like 30,000 people watching.
Right. So it's one of those things where
So what's the news?
The news is this, that
new owners own the Dodgers. They try to launch the sports channel. The satellite people say, we're not interested. You're charging too much money. You can make it a premium channel and people who want it can pay for it, but we're not putting it in our basic cap package. That's the story. So what happened today?
Well, what happened, it's been happening over the past couple of weeks, is that
while you were away.
Yes. Vin Scully is retiring. He is the legendary broadcaster. Well, this actually plays into it. He's a legendary broadcaster, wouldn't you say, Michael? I mean, he is.
Sure. Of course. Yes. Everybody's heard of Vin Scully. Keep going.
Not everybody outside the United States has heard of Vin Scully.
Yes. I know.
He is basically the voice of the Dodgers.
Right.
And
every
has been
team practically has the voice of their team. Often a team gets somebody, they stand there for 30 years, and there's a beloved voice of the Baltimore Orioles. There's a beloved voice of every damn franchise in sports. But Vin Scully's actually a great one. And a lot of people, even outside of the Dodgers, have heard his name.
60-something years the guy's been doing this, okay? And he's retiring. And so Time Warner said, look, we're going to drop the price by 30%.
Because everyone wants to hear Vin Scully in his last season.
Right. And he's like 89, 88 years old, okay? And AT&T and DirecTV and Cox, they all said, yeah, no, we're not interested.
Right. You want to be a premium channel? You can.
Right. And so now Time Warner has finally said, you know what? We give up. We've tried everything. We lowered the price. We lowered the price to what, I guess, what is it? Dish or DirecTV owns a regional sports network, as they're called, RSNs, in Seattle, in Washington State. And they charge $3.84 a month. So they said, okay, Time Warner said, we'll charge
that's
the same.
That's not how life works. When you own it yourself, it's different. So what? Yes. So, and what happened when they said we lowered the price? What has happened? What's the news?
The news is they have given up trying to negotiate. They've thrown in the towel. They said, we can't negotiate. We've tried everything.
They can negotiate. You can be a premium channel and charge whatever you want. We'll be happy to carry you.
That is the one thing that they haven't tried.
So they're not willing to do it. So, okay, so nothing's happened. They've refused to be a premium channel, and they'd rather nobody be able to watch the Dodgers on satellite or whatever. So it's carried on the cable channels, right? Carried on cable.
It's carried on Time Warner cable. And right. Now, get this, Michael, Charter. Do you know why? Because Charter's trying to buy Time Warner. So, of course, that deal was struck almost immediately.
So the satellite people said, hey, we'll carry it. You want it? It's a premium channel. And they said, no, thank you. That's
correct.
It. End of story.
But this is the reason why this story is important. Yes, it's in Los Angeles. Yes, it's a major market. Yes, it's a big team. And yes, it's a lot of money. But more to the point is this whole mini bundles and unbundling and all that stuff, you can see it starting to fray in stories like this. You can see that whole packaging, you know, and the whole basic cable. You can see all basic cables coming undone, and you're seeing it with these sports networks.
Oh, I see. You're saying because there are other options now.
Yes, and
people
are saying,
with DirecTV are keeping it. They're not upset about not having access to the Dodgers.
Correct.
They're not saying they're not canceling their DirecTV or their Cox Communications subscription. They're saying, I'm fine with it.
Correct.
If
and
I
they're
cared,
not upset.
I would buy Time Warner Cable in my area or Comcast, and I don't care. Because there's a million options out there, and that's not important enough to me to pay $150 a month for my cable bill.
Correct.
I see. And the bargaining power is not with the people who have the sports channel anymore. It's not with the Yankees anymore if they had to do it. It's with the people who have access, DirecTV and Cox and whoever's going to have an online like Apple. They're the ones with the power now because people want lower rates. They don't think they need 500 channels, and they're going to live with whatever they get.
Right. And I've heard this said before. And that is content is king. Well, if content is king, I've also heard it said distribution is God. And that's what you're seeing here.
Well, I think it's just a balance, you know,
between kings and gods.
Yeah. I mean, there's one does not trump the other. It just depends on the situation. You know, you can be a distributor, but if you don't have NBC, ABC, CBS and PBS, guess what? No one's going to buy your product. So, you know, then content is king suddenly. But then if you've got enough happy ones that people are fine with your package, do you need the LA Dodgers network? No, you don't. So it goes back and forth.
No, but I do need Wolf Hall, apparently.
Okay.
Then do you know why?
No.
Because the BAFTAs love Wolf Hall.
Well, sure. This is the miniseries based on the novel by Hilary Mantel. Terrific book. Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies. Bring Up or Bring Back the Bodies. Two very good books about Thomas Cromwell. They star Oscar winner Mark Rylance, we can say that now. And here in the U.S., it was considered a miniseries. What did the BAFTAs call it?
Not a miniseries. I think they called it a drama.
Yeah, I guess it's because they're going to do a sequel, maybe, with the Bring Up the Bodies book. And there will be a third book eventually. But really, this is a miniseries. So I guess that trouble we always have of, you know, complaining about the Emmys and is it a miniseries? Is it an ongoing series? What is it? Is it a TV movie? They're not the only ones with that trouble.
Apparently, no. The top miniseries over at the BAFTAs were Dr. Foster, The Enfield Haunting, London Spy with Ben Whishaw, and This is England 1990, or This is England 90.
Yes, that's a spun-off from a movie that is great, This is England. London Spy is with Ben Whishaw, who's on Broadway, and The Crucible just got rave reviews. Boy, is London Spy boring. I don't know how it got nominated for Best Miniseries, and I haven't seen the other two.
Well, and over in drama, you got Wolf Hall, and then you have No Offense. and The Last Panthers and Humans.
That's right. And you can see all these shows are playing in the U.S. The Last Panthers is coming. Humans is on, I think, Sci-Fi or BBC America. So all these different shows are available and they're coming here. So the crossover, this is why we care about the BAFTAs, because you read about a scripted comedy. I haven't heard of this one, Chewing Gum. Well, I'm going to keep my eyes open when it comes here in the U.S. I'll give it a shot.
Unless it's on late at night, in which case you might fall asleep, in which case your eyes will be closed.
In which case I'll set my DVR.
Ah, you see, and then it won't matter what channel it's on.
No, then it won't be a big deal at all.
Oh, wait, did you just say big and deal together? Because then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, I literally, this was the only story I read over the last week or two, and my head was spinning. I couldn't believe this was happening and that Robert De Niro's name was in it. The Tribeca Film Festival, which of course De Niro helped start, has inoculated itself against criticism for being anti-science and a patsy for a fraud. Now you might be asking how. They did this by yanking the documentary film Vaxxed from controversy to cover-up. That's a movie that was co-written and directed by Andrew Wakefield, a disgraced British scientist, beloved of conspiracy theorists, like actress Jenny McCarthy. Wakefield authored a study published in The Lancet that indicated a link between vaccines and autism. He later had to retract the study when it didn't withstand scientific scrutiny, and then lost his medical license for both ethics violations and failure to reveal financial conflicts of interest. Oops. Many studies since then have made a hash of any link between vaccines and autism. De Niro initially defended showing the film, saying he had a child with autism and thought that all issues surrounding autism be openly discussed and examined. Later, they decided to yank the film entirely for being without merit on a scientific level. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but thank goodness for them that they did it. It's hard to, change your mind publicly and not just buckle down and say, well, we're just going to show the movie. We could have a panel after the movie in which people could critique it, So they could have done a lot of things, but, happily, they stopped and listened and said, oh, well, wait a second. I mean, it's not even a movie about Wakefield. It's a movie by him, for God's sake, the man who's been disgraced. So, it's hard if you're a parent and your child has a condition or suffering from an illness of something. It's hard to be rational. You're going to be looking for clues and answers. And so I empathize with them not necessarily, looking deeper into it or thinking maybe he's got something to say. But they certainly made the right decision.
I wonder if he had seen the film before authorizing its programming.
Maybe not. Who knows?
Dame Judi Dench is the winningest stage actor in UK history, having just snagged her 8th Olivier Award. This one for supporting actress in a Kenneth Branagh revival of The Winter's Tale. Women of a certain age dominated, with Imelda Staunton winning Best Actress and Gypsy Best Musical Revival for that acclaimed production, which is headed to the U.S. in 2017, Kinky Boots won Best New Musical and Best Actor for Matt Henry. Martin McDonagh's drama, Hangmen, won Best New Play. And since Hamilton hasn't opened in London yet, they had to settle for awarding Lin-Manuel Miranda Best Score for In the Heights, his previous work. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because anytime you see a show like this, you're like, ah. I want to see Gypsy when it comes to New York. I want to see Hangmen. So it's a nice heads up. Just like the BAFTAs, you want to pay attention so you know what shows to be excited about when they come to Broadway.
Or when they come to, they do national touring.
Absolutely, all over the world.
Gypsy, wouldn't have given it a second thought. I would have seen it, on the flyers or the advertisement. I would have said, I'm not seeing that again. I've seen it 5 times.
Oh, the rave reviews. This has just been the most. I know 3 people who've seen it, and they're just like, it's the best Gypsy ever. I'm very excited to see. I was very sorry Imelda Staunton didn't come to America with her revival of Sweeney Todd. That was the first time I knew she could sing. And now this production, thank God it's coming.
Yeah, well, and now I'm looking forward to seeing it. The state of Georgia, oh, brother. Well, they've passed an anti-gay bill that tries to make it illegal, or legal, I should say, again, to discriminate against gays, lesbians, and transgender people in countless areas such as jobs, businesses, and residences. The bill has reached the governor, who must decide whether to sign it into law by May 3rd. Meanwhile, many major corporations that do business in Georgia, including entertainment companies, are speaking out. AMC, which shoots The Walking Dead primarily in Georgia, is joined by Disney, Marvel, Viacom, Warner Brothers, and virtually everyone else in saying they will boycott the state. Companies based in Atlanta like Coca-Cola, Home Depot, UPS, and Cox are also denouncing the bill. Heck, even the NFL says its decision to hold the Super Bowl in Atlanta in a year or two would be revoked.
And NFL hates gay people.
That's true. Guess what? Guess what? It worked. The Georgia governor plans to veto the bill. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It is interesting. This is why we're talking about that. All these entertainment companies spoke up so quickly. Bad for business. The governor decided to veto the bill. But Variety, this is what I really like, why I want to talk about the story. Variety had a great story linking to this. It said, oh, yeah, that's really great that you think that this is an important issue. And you spoke out about Georgia. And of course, North Carolina has a similar issue going on right now. And they said, but by the way, you know, Hollywood, you do a lot of business in a lot of places that are terrible about human rights. And it began with Abu Dhabi as their number one example of where Hollywood films movies and gets tax breaks. And they don't care about the record of Abu Dhabi for women and for Jews and for gays and for its horrific, you know, basically slavery for the businesses that are being built there. And so I thought that was a really nice feat to the fire. Like, oh, it's easy to say, oh, Georgia's terrible. But look at all the money you're making in all these other countries.
Well, yeah. And I wonder if the comeback for that, and I'm not saying it's a right or
it's wrong
or just
don't say
one,
it. It's wrong.
What did you think I was going to say?
Doesn't matter. I know it's wrong.
Well, OK, then I guess now our listeners will just have to guess what I'm saying. But
what are you going
to
say?
That the pushback that somebody might give is, well, you know what? We can control what happens in our own country where the Supreme Court of the United States has said this, that, and the other thing is illegal and some state is trying to overturn that in some other country. Now, what I would say is, yeah, that's a nice little...
They're going to extra effort to go to Abu Dhabi to film.
Precisely.
They don't give a damn. They go there and have film festivals and they have vacations. Abu Dhabi's great. And it's built and it's denounced by the UN and Amnesty International and every rights organization around the world as, you know, using slave labor. Women who get raped, if they try to complain to the police, are thrown into jail because if you're raped, you are a whore and they throw you into jail. You know, this is not a country you should be doing business with. So, no, that doesn't work.
Okay, well, then let's move on to the doctor.
You can't tell other countries how to govern themselves, but you don't have to make money there.
Good point. And that's where I was headed with my comment, which is, you know, it's a nice pushback that doesn't necessarily work. Now,
which means it's not a nice pushback.
That was kind of said in an ironic way, but okay. The doctor has made many companions over the years. And yes,
Tramp.
Well, okay. Hey, before you start, labeling people, we're talking about Doctor Who, okay? He's almost as promiscuous with his streaming services. The BBC's iconic franchise has been available via streaming on Netflix and Hulu Plus. Today, The Good Doctor is switching to Amazon Prime, where all 8 seasons of the current iteration of the show, plus all the holiday specials and one-offs, will be available starting right away. Season 9 will be added in the fall. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it brings us back to Sunny in Philadelphia and Archer. And in this case, it is hard to find where reruns are hosted. When I wanted to catch up on last season of Archer before the new one began, I spent hours trying to figure out where the heck it was and how could I access it and where could I watch it. It's not easy. So keeping track of where to find Doctor Who if you want to watch a previous season, it ain't easy. Now it's on Amazon Prime. So, you know, you go look at Hulu, you go look at Netflix, and you maybe give up sometimes. So this is a growing problem in the sense of people just knowing where to turn to find something. Whether or not they want to pay for it is another issue. But I think this is an increasing problem. Somebody needs a portal, and I know that's what Apple and everyone's trying to work on, so that you don't have to worry about where it's at. You can easily find out and know, okay, this is what you have to do if you want it, but one system so that you can reach everything everywhere. Whoever gets paid is fine, but you shouldn't have to go to 18 different sites just to figure out where it's at.
Well, and before somebody writes in, okay, and I know we'll get a couple emails about this, there is a service called Go Watch It where you can sometimes do that for most movies, especially in television shows. You can
really, they have all every current and past season of every show. They tell you everywhere it's at for every show that's ever been made.
You know, when you get that detail oriented, I couldn't tell you. But Archer, for instance, Archer, let's look this up. I'm doing it live right now. Archer.
I want to know every season, not just the current.
Oh, it's just movies. It's just movies. Sorry.
Movies is easy. It's still a lot of work, though. So that's not totally useless. I don't want to downplay what they've accomplished because new on demand. Does it have on demand? Is it a Blu-ray, DVD, streaming, everything, cable?
Oh,
or
yeah.
Is it just where it's airing on cable TV this week?
No. It's got Amazon Video, Vudu, get it on iTunes, Google Play,
What about on demand and streaming and cable plays? Like, is it on TBS this week? They just had a BBC America just had a James Bond marathon this weekend. Would that have been on there?
James Bond?
Like the reruns on airing on TBS or CNN next week, you know, something like that. Or is it just like the library is here?
I think it does do that, but I'd have to know something that was on.
You mentioned a service that doesn't candle TV and you're not sure what it offers in movies. But yeah, this is the problem. Doctor Who is leaving Netflix and it's going to Amazon Prime. And if you look at the Netflix catalog, there have been a couple stories about this. Their catalog in the US has shrunk by a third since 2014. It had about 8,100 movies and TV shows. I'm not sure if that's classified as episodes or entire shows, but they had about 8,000 plus offerings. Now, in March of 2016, 3 years later, 2 years later, that's down to 5,500 offerings. So that's a significant shrinkage. And of course, costs are up. They're making more original programming because they know they're sort of trapped. You know, people come there for the big, deep catalog, but they're at the mercy of time of Warner Brothers and Disney. You know, how much do they want to charge? So they knew we got to create original content. That way, you're willing to pay for Netflix, even if we don't have that old Disney rerun you're looking for.
And by the way, you can go to TV Guide and it will tell you the same stuff.
No. TV Guide will not. TV Guide is not comprehensive. It is not. Your TV Guide does not tell you where all past 8 seasons or 6 seasons of Archer are available and when and how. It does not do that.
It doesn't? Are you sure about
that? Absolutely not.
Okay.
Absolutely not. Because that stuff changes all the time and they do not have that up to date.
Actually, when I see it says Archer TV show, watch on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, but that's new current episodes. That's not every past season of Archer.
I don't know. Maybe it is. I don't know.
It's not. I know it isn't. I just looked it up.
Okay, fine.
And it doesn't tell you that there was a marathon last weekend of season 8 or 6. I think we're on season 7, maybe. No, it's very, very complicated to tell you what. Like, look at Doctor Who. It's very, you have different seasons and they're not available all the time on every channel. You know, sometimes they're only available
You can get all of them? BitTorrent.
Nice. Yeah, so Netflix catalog shrinking, Netflix original programming growing. That's, you know, what they're doing. Their big catalog is shrinking by a third. The original programming is increasing. It's been doubling for the last few years.
Well, you know what's really complicated is animation. However, animation software customized and used by famed Japanese company Studio Ghibli will soon be available for free.
Hi!
Toons Ghibli, it's called the Toons Ghibli Edition, I should say, is available now, having just debuted at Anime Japan. It will be free to use and update, along with varied extensions and apps, making it ideal for amateurs, classrooms, and the like. Toons Premium will continue to be updated and marketed for corporate customers, so enterprise users, so to speak. The idea, of course, is to make Toons a worldwide standard for 2D animation. Big deal or big whoop?
I don't know. Is this a good play? Does this make sense? Is that the business model? Like, you get kids using it, so then when they become adults and go work at a studio, that's the animation software they want to use? Or what's the point?
I don't know. Why don't you ask Microsoft? Because that's exactly what they did. They gave Microsoft Office away to schools for free, and then when people got into the workforce, they wanted to use Microsoft Word and Microsoft Excel, and, you know, they were used to it. So it does work. The question is really, you know...
This is such a specialized market, though. This isn't the world. This is very few people are going to be using animation software.
Right.
Which is why I wondered how that would play out in the corporate world, which is, you know, very small universe compared to
But this is a classic freemium model where it's like, okay, here's a not a dumbed down version, but a limited version of a piece of software or service. And if you want the full kit, then you got to go and pay for it. Very, okay. Very common business model. Hong Kong is feeling feisty. After China overtook the territory and has been slowly backtracking on promises of allowing it to remain independent, Hong Kong is fighting back. It continues to make noise over China grabbing Hong Kong publishers, literally, and I don't mean like the businesses, I mean the people. And now the Hong Kong Film Festival has crowned a winner called 10 Years. The movie is a collection of shorts depicting life in Hong Kong 10 years into the future under Chinese rule. And you know what? That picture ain't pretty. In one, Cantonese has been outlawed. In another, a political activist sets himself on fire, which makes the supporters of Bernie Sanders seem pretty tame when they say they can feel the burn. The film was actually screened in Hong Kong, but since theaters couldn't show it, it was projected in various public venues and became a modest hit. Yet another example of the localism movement. Chinese broadcasters refused to air or even stream the award ceremony, and one tabloid Chinese paper described 10 years as, quote, a disease of the mind. Big deal or big whoop?
Sounds like a great blurb.
Yes.
It's a disease of the mind.
The best film of the year, says Time Magazine. A disease of the mind, says the entire country of China.
Yeah, it's obviously a big whoop, but these symbolic protests matter. And we'll have to see what happens. It's not to this one movie or to this director, but I have to see what happens with Hong Kong overall over the next decade or so.
Every year, the Library of Congress adds a wide range of audio recordings to its national registry. It's hard to beat the list's diversity, which ranges from an old radio soap opera to Billy Joel's single Piano Man, which stops along the way for Blind Willie McTell, a speech about the Marshall Plan, George Carlin, the comedian, not one but two versions of Mac the Knife, the score to the film A Streetcar Named Desire, and of course, Metallica's Master of Puppets. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, of course, but, you know, it's always cool to see what's making the list. And every year you go, what? John Coltrane's A Love Supreme wasn't on the list already? That just goes to show you how much music and audio recording there is. I mean, from all the world of radio, there's a lot of stuff out there. I mean, a speech about the Marshall Plan. You can see how wide-ranging this is. But it's cool. And nowadays, you can find it all on YouTube practically, or of course, pay for it if it's something that's modern and not in the public domain. So the cool thing is, you can go listen to that speech about the Marshall Plan. You can hear a bit of that old radio soap opera. You can hear George Carlin say those words he shouldn't be saying. And I think that makes these lists a lot more fun.
Look, it's only seven. It's only seven words you shouldn't say on television. Safety on the set of movies and TV shows gained worldwide prominence after the tragic and preventable death of camera operator Sarah Jones on a Greg Allman biopic. The director of the movie, Midnight Rider, pled guilty and was sentenced to 2 years in jail. Now Randall Miller has been released after just over 1 year behind bars. Miller will be on probation for 9 years and is barred from working as a director, assistant director, or oddly, being in charge of on-set safety for the next decade.
Did they really have to put that in the deal?
Yeah,
was somebody going to hire him for that? I mean, it just seemed a bit bizarre.
The family, friends, and other crew members denounced his being set free, even under those terms. Big deal or big whoop?
If you're a family and friend, obviously it's a big deal for everybody else. This is what happens when people go to jail. They don't usually serve their full time. It's painful, but that's how the system works. It's sad. I'm glad that there was real jail time. I'm glad this was more than just a symbolic, you know, slap on the wrist or, oh, this isn't, you know, no one should die from making a movie. No one should die from a preventable accident when making the movie, more to the point. So that was certainly the case here. So I'm glad he went to jail. As far as being on parole, it's never going to be a good time to see him free if you're those people.
Well, and, you know, yes, this is tragic. You know, there's nothing good to say here, except maybe one thing. When crews begin to think about, quote unquote, stealing a shot, which is what they were trying to do there, where you kind of do something,
right,
you know, they'll think twice now.
Exactly.
Okay, so if there's one little tinge of good to come out of that, that might be it. Now, speaking of tinges of good, porn is coming to virtual reality, sort of. A website called Pornhub has launched a VR channel. It's not truly immersive virtual reality because that would be too expensive for the adult film industry to bother with. However, it will offer 180-degree and 360-degree visibility for the action being filmed because, of course, who wants to see that? Now, here's my question. Is Michael finally interested in VR at this point?
Keep going.
Okay. Oh, and by the way, we talked about the PlayStation VR package that is going to be available in October. You might recall us doing that. The available package sold out on Amazon within minutes. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, often porn leads the way in new technology. It's not the case here because of the expense involved, but it's no surprise to see that they would be, you know, exploring it and doing what they can to stay on top of it. So that's interesting. Far more interesting is the fact that the PlayStation VR package sold out right away. Obviously, they want to make more available, but it's hard to produce them. So, I mean, you know, finally, we've been hearing about virtual reality for years. Until my feeling was always, until there's something people can actually watch, until they've got headsets they can buy, I'm sick of talking about it. Well, now it's finally happening.
Because people can watch porn.
No, not porn. The porn isn't even VR. It's just, it's not the porn. It's the fact that they're finally getting headsets in stores and people are able to buy them. Two of them are out now. The third is coming in the fall. It's a decent price where actual people can buy it rather than just, you know, the super wealthy. You know, $400 is not too much money for that PlayStation package. So, I mean, it's certainly a luxury item, but it is an actual consumer thing now rather than just pie in the sky stuff. Now we can play the games, we can look at the stuff, and we can talk about the actual content rather than just speculating.
Okay. Easter weekend. It's always a popular time on Broadway. Between families looking for a special event and shows adding an extra performance or two, the box office is always robust. 2016, no different at all, with 13 musicals grossing more than $1 million and three of them grossing more than $2 million. The three that grossed more than $2 million were Lion King, Wicked, and Aladdin. So I guess Disney did quite well. All of whom added shows, by the way. Of the new shows, Fiddler on the Roof, School of Rock, and I'll give you one guess as to what the third was.
My name is Alexander Hamilton.
That's right, Hamilton. They all scored big. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's one of the biggest weeks of the year. This and the Christmas New Year period is obviously a huge moneymaker for Broadway. Normally, I wouldn't let people get away with just talking about grosses, you know, like, well, what did the movie cost to make? Same thing on Broadway. What does it cost to run the show every week? But the fact is, except for Spider-Man, pretty much any show that grosses $1 million a week or more is making money. May not be making a ton of money, but for a big fancy musical, the very rough rule of thumb is, you know, $600,000 to $700,000 a week running cost. And that's a very broad sum. And that's not a hard and fast rule. A lot of variables are involved. But when you're looking at a big elaborate musical, that's certainly in the rough ballpark. So any show making $1 million, clearly they had a big profitable weekend. So while we always want to keep an eye on the running costs, you know, in this case, you're making $1 million or $2 million, you made a lot of money.
Well, and 34 shows were playing on Broadway last week, $31 million combined.
Yep.
It's not bad. Okay, so that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. This week, how are they going to affect you? Well, you're going to have a little bit more money in your pocket if you buy some of these dime store novels. So here's what we're talking about. Short, cheap, and entertaining books. That's what a dime store novel is, okay? That's what, you know, pulp fiction, dime store novels, that's what they are. Short, cheap, and entertaining books. They are making a comeback. As are, by the way, serialized novels, short stories, and lots of things that don't fit into the 250 pages or more standard of most books today. Technology and the need to hold people's attention are the reason that's happening. So what's going on here, Michael? Why is this happening? Besides those reasons that I mentioned, how is technology playing a part of this?
Well, you know, form follows function, right? When you've got cassettes, suddenly people are making mixtapes. When you've got blank CDs, they do the same. Or blank DVDs, they can suddenly tape shows on TV. Blank VHS, all these things affect what people can do with technology to enjoy stuff. When you've got albums fitting on an LP, they're about 40 minutes long, 20 minutes aside. When you go to CD, suddenly people are making albums that were 60 minutes long. Not always a good idea, but they did it. You know, sometimes there are a lot of albums in the 80s that should have been shorter, but they had the room and they filled it up. So you'll always see an impact on what sort of art is created by the format or the technology that's available to make that art. Songs couldn't be more than 3 minutes long because that's all that would fit onto a 78. So, you know, this is what happens when you've got more room, you've got more flexibility. That's going to affect the art that's created. In this case, we're seeing a lot of people with access to entertainment and text on their phone, on their Kindle, on their ebook, on their laptop, whatever. They're reading books and things on their phone. But of course, when you're reading on the phone and you're traveling, a short story, a novella, something quick and short is a lot more appealing than a 500, 600 page novel. So that stuff is got more of an audience again. For a while, where would you do a serialized novel? Where would you put a novella? Who's reading short stories?
It would have to be like in an anthology of some kind, right? Or some literary
anthologies, yeah, or collections. But nowadays, it's a lot quicker and easier to download a new short story by Stephen King. If he puts one out, people will buy it. And it's easy. They can pay $1 or 75 cents or $1.50. Boom, it's on their Kindle. It's on their phone. And they can read it and enjoy it. And it's done.
So what is James Patterson doing?
Well, James Patterson started in advertising, And now he is in the publishing industry as an author, and he started as his own best-selling author. Now he's basically his own industry. He gets other authors to come together with him. He comes up with an idea. They work on it together. That person runs off and writes the book. He gives it a polish, and it goes out as by James Patterson and Michael Giltz, or by James Patterson.
When he gives it a polish, what is he doing? Like,
well, it varies from book to book and author to author, but he partners with people. And then believe me, there's 10,000 people waiting to do it with him. So he has his choice of who he wants to work with. And these are often authors who've been successful on their own, but they did not break through to the top level. So they're good writers. So there's all these people desperate for his name brand, and he picks and chooses who he thinks can work with, and they have the right vibe together, and they come up with a book or a series, and they start to create them. And then eventually that person becomes successful enough to go back on their own. So he's got this big powerhouse thing. He puts out like 15, 20 books a year, if not more, and they are quick reads. So when James Patterson suddenly announced, I want short novels, I'm like, how much shorter can they get, James? His books are like, you turn the pages and it's almost, you know, they're
such fast reads. Yeah, but he's been very commercially successful, and he seems to have his finger on the pulse of what works.
And so what he wants to do is put out books that are only 150 pages or less.
So would one of them be Along Came a Short Story, or Along Came Another Author I Can Work With?
No, it would be more, you know, 100 pages, 150 pages, not a short story, but he's going to have books that are available and they're only 150 pages. So, you know, you see this line of books, you know, I can grab it. I can sit down and read it in an evening and I'll be done. You can read it in one sitting. That's the goal that he wants. And he's also wants to reach new areas. He feels like there are a lot of readers who don't go to bookstores. They don't buy ebooks, but they do go to the drugstore. And with James Patterson's name brand, he can get CVS and Duane Reade and these people to put a stand by the register like they used to have, and have a grab book you can grab for $5, and it's 150 pages, and you know you can grab it and read and have fun. So they can have that Pulp Fiction feel. They can have great covers, quick reads, and they're going to be at the front of the store. Right now, if you go to a drugstore in a lot of places in America, the magazines, and they all have paperbacks, a handful of them, with people like James Patterson, but they're in the back in the corner far away. They're not impulse buys. And so he thinks there's people to reach. There's people with time on their hands that want to read something, but they don't want to commit to even a 300-page book. And so he's got this new niche where he's going to put out short, punchy books that are 150 pages or less, and he's going to get them available so you can grab them and impulse buy them and then read them in an evening.
Well, and you know, for a fact, since we covered this last week, or a week ago.
Or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, at this point. That To Kill a Mockingbird won't be there, since they've done away with the dime store versions.
This is not about every book being available. Again, that's over. This is not what we're talking about. We're talking about new line of books that are even shorter than most novels, are at least 200 pages or more. Then you get 180 pages, you get some smaller. This is a substantially shorter than most novels are these days. Nowadays, 250, 300 plus pages is sort of the standard. He's going to say, hey, there's room for shorter books. There's room for punchier books. And I can get places that don't carry books prominently to do it so that people can buy them.
And what is Julian Fellowes doing? Of course, Julian Fellowes of Downton Abbey fame.
Well, he's serializing a novel. Serialized novels never really went away. Of course, they used to dominate. That's how Dickens and Trollope. Did Trollope? Yeah, I think Trollope did it too. But Dickens and a lot of authors
really did
serialized.
It was William Makepeace Thackeray. If you ever had to read one of his books, oh my God, they just go on and on. And you're like, why am I reading this still? And the reason you're reading it is because it had to be another, you know, they got paid by the story. So,
and sometimes by the word, and they were published in newspapers and magazines and drove sales, and the Sherlock Holmes stories were available serialized, and the novels were serialized, and all these things happened. And of course, they come in and out of fashion. You had Tales of the City in the 70s, and Julian Fellowes says, hey, we've got this ebook technology now. This is a great time to do a serialized novel again. So he has a new book called Belgravia. It comes out starting like this week, I believe. And the first two installments are coming out, and there'll be another chapter a week for like 12 weeks. And by the end of the 12 weeks, you will have read a whole novel. And so each week you wait for the new chapter and it'll have a cliffhanger ending, I assume. And so it's just a fun use of technology. That's something you really couldn't do, practically speaking, unless you partner with a newspaper or magazine. But he can just do it with a publishing house, and it works and it makes sense.
Well, and then you've got like Amazon does these like, I think they call them single shots, right? Atavist has the Atavist is they do these I don't know, they're like one-offs, right?
Right. A lot of newspapers and magazines are trying to extend their brand this way as well. A single shots from Amazon are short stories, or maybe they'll do a short 80-page biography of Bernie Sanders tied to the election.
Right.
Or the LA Times will do that. Or they'll have a book about the current election and all the issues that are at hand. Or they'll do something about an in-depth reporting of Belgravia. They'll do an in-depth reporting on an earthquake that took place. And they'll pull together all their coverage and craft it into a thing that's not a quite a book length work or something that they have to wait a year and a half to publish, but they can get it out now and they've done the work. And so they bring it together and say, hey, here's an 80-page thing that's really, if you're interested in the Super Bowl, or you're interested in the Olympics, or you're interested in this fire that took place, here's something more meaty and substantial that you can read about it. Maybe The Guardian in the UK, they've just done this huge expose of offshore bank accounts for all these world leaders and big financial powers. Friends of Vladimir Putin have, you know, funneled billions of dollars out of Russia. And the details of where that money is and when is being reported every day, every week now in The Guardian and other newspapers around the world. They're digging into all these files that were leaked. And I bet you at some point they'll say, they'll put it together into some 80-page fun read about, you know, what happened and how and where it went. And, you know, you don't need to wait 3 years for the book. You can read about it right away. So it's more timely. It's more fun. It's easier to get out because you can do it electronically. You don't have to wait for that cycle of publishing that used to take 2 years. And, you know, it's easy to read. You want to read a short story? You got a short story. You want to read a serialized novel? You got that. So the technology is making all this stuff possible.
Well, it wasn't a short story necessarily, more like a novella, right? But Legends of the Fall author, Jim Harrison, passed away.
That's right. We segued into obituaries, and Jim Harrison is perfect because the novella fell out of favor, of course. It's always been sort of a bastard child, but nowadays it's got sort of a rebirth because people like James Patterson and others say, hey, there's room for a novella because people can get it, they can read it quickly, and they're done. Jim Harrison was a novelist, and he was always critically acclaimed, but until he did a novella, that sort of bastard stepchild, he didn't really have popular success, but Legends of the Fall became a big success, and then he repeatedly over his career had success with the novella link. That was just somehow the sweet spot for what he did. And, you know, he worked in Hollywood, didn't do very much good writing, but he had a lot of fun. He wrote poetry. In fact, he got a Guggenheim for poetry even before he was known for fiction. And he wrote about food for Esquire. I bet you can find some of that online if you want to buy some of that stuff. And he wrote novellas. So the novella would have been just right, perfect for him. And if he was just coming along today, he'd have a lot easier chance to get his work out and read.
Well, somebody who didn't have a problem of getting their work out was Gary Shandling, who passed away, you know, quite suddenly at 66.
Yeah, he's young, 66.
And it was reported he had a heart attack and died suddenly. And the television world, the entertainment world here in the U.S. mourned him greatly.
Absolutely. He was, you know, neck and neck with Jay Leno to take over The Tonight Show. You know, he could have been the one that took over for Carson once Joan Rivers, abandoned and betrayed Carson and went off on her own. She was the heir apparent. And then later we had two people. You had Gary Shandling and Jay Leno. It ended up going to Jay Leno, but Gary Shandling was definitely in the running. Turns out he kind of maybe didn't even really want it, or maybe it was just because he didn't get The Tonight Show. He didn't want to go anywhere else, but he was offered to follow The Tonight Show. Other networks offered him a late night talk show. He was, you know, an it boy. And he said, I don't want to do a talk show. I want to do a fake talk show. So, you know, he did his sitcom, the It's Gary Shandling Show. That was on Showtime. And that was a great success.
A show on Fox? This is the theme to Gary Show.
No, that's the Showtime show, Gary Shandling Show.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, that was on Showtime. It was one of the Showtime early on had great success alongside HBO. Then they sort of fell by the wayside. Now they've caught up again to a degree. But that was on Showtime. And then he did the Larry Sanders Show, which is his spoof of talk shows. That was on HBO from 1992 to 1998. Both of them legendary shows, both of them hugely influential. So, you know, he definitely left his mark on comedy.
Now, somebody else who passed away, Patty Duke, actress Patty Duke, and an activist for mental health. She passed away at 69, also relatively suddenly.
69 is pretty young these days, so that was a shame. She died, and, you know, of course, the Patty Duke show, everybody remembers that. And then Ken Howard died. He was the current acting head of SAG-AFTRA. He was part of them when they merged together. And, of course, he's best known for The White Shadow, but he did everything from 30 Rock recently to Dynasty and the Colbys, and he was 71, so he died rather unexpectedly as well. So a lot of people died in the last few weeks, but, you know, The work lives on.
Yes, as does our work, although maybe not next week. We will find out. So stay tuned. Actually, it's like a cliffhanger, Michael.
And just subscribe to it. It's like a serialized podcast. They just need to, what's it called? Night Vale. You know, they need to subscribe to Twitter so they can find out what's going to happen next week.
Not only on Twitter, but go to iTunes, search for our show, Showbiz Sandbox, and subscribe there. Or, you know, you can do the same thing in Stitcher or the same thing in the Microsoft Marketplace. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can find our show. And if you can't, please do let us know. You can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can find all of that information, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, on showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us in any one of those podcast aggregators on Stitcher, iTunes. That's where you'll find the way to follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, you can usually find our page there. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. Michael, what is it this week?
It's pulpfictionlives.com. Strangely, Quentin Tarantino does not own that website. It's up for grabs.
PulpFictionLives.com? Okay, yeah. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there at PulpFictionLives.com, which apparently he's currently buying, why not head on over to the Huffington Post or MichaelGiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, you can always check out BookFilter.com. Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until, well, maybe next week or the week after, play nice.